is OWC Radio number 52. I'm Tim Robertson. Thanks for downloading this episode. Remember, if you have any questions or you want to comment on the show, go to blog.maxsales.com or send us an email. It's owcradio@maxsales.com. This week, I've got a really fun guest because I don't know this person at all. I've heard his show once or twice. I thought he'd be great to have on the podcast. And listen to this description and tell me if this isn't something that's like perfectly right up my alley. Skeptoid is a weekly science podcast dedicated to furthering knowledge by blasting away at the widespread pseudosciences that infect popular culture and replacing them with way cooler reality. Isn't that perfect? Brian Dunning is my guest this week. He is the host and creator of that show. Welcome, Brian.
Hey, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
What a great description for a podcast. That is just perfect.
I wrote that 8 years ago, and I don't think I've heard it since you read it.
Really? You can't top that. That's perfect. I mean, it really is. And to me, it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart, because all of us, especially those of us who are really into science and geeky things, hate the pseudoscience stuff that we hear out there. Oh, you can't go swimming, you know, right after you eat. You get cramps. It's crazy. Stuff that my mother and your mother used to spout that they just took for granted. It's just not true. Well, where do you go to find out that these things aren't true? Well, that's what you do.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about those of us who are into science and geeky things. And correct me if I'm wrong, but when you were a kid, did you read all the books about UFOs and Bigfoots and watch Star Trek and In Search Of and all of that stuff?
Half of it. Some of it I just knew wasn't true, like Bigfoot. I wanted to believe in a Bigfoot, but just the idea that science has never captured one, that there's been no bones, there's no real video of it other than that one loopy video where he's dragging his arms. I just knew that couldn't be true.
Well, that's very advanced thinking for a little kid. I'll grant you that. So congratulations and kudos for that. But most of us came into this field via that route. We were really into science fiction. We were really into stuff that seemed weird and just stuff that was amazing. And that's what kind of triggers this appreciation for learning and amazing things, and the most amazing things are in the world of science. They're
absolutely
out in the universe for real. They are the true explanations of all of these stories that we've heard.
And you know, for me, what got me the most interested in science was Star Wars. This idea of spaceships and the Force, and there's something greater than us, and it's a big galaxy. That really started opening my eyes. But rather than leading me to, you know, maybe a religion, which a lot of people thought the Force was all about and Jedi Knights were about back in the day.
Yeah, I've heard that.
It was more about the technology. How do they go faster than light? You know, how could they survive in the ship and it has to make its own oxygen? Those kind of things really intrigued me as a kid. And as an adult, I think, look, I love science fiction. I love it. It's one of my favorite things. But actual science, actual Mother Nature and space, and there's so much that we just don't know. I get jazzed up just thinking about it. Just the things that we're going to learn in the next 50 years compared to the last 50.
Yeah, each block of 50 years is always way better than the previous one.
It is. Well, yes and no. I mean, if you go back 2,000 years,
well, yeah,
and you move forward, things
they were
didn't,
all the same.
Well, not all the same, but things change so slowly. But over the last 120 years, our species has advanced in a technological sense way beyond anything that anyone could have ever predicted. Mm-hmm. It's insane. Mm-hmm. So let's go way back. When you were in high school, what did you think you were going to be doing?
I think in my high school days, I was just doing I was fiddling with computer programming, and my dream in those days was to be a computer scientist working on the space shuttle program.
Really? Well, good that thing was, you didn't get into that, because you'd be out of a job now.
I would indeed. And so in pursuit of that goal, I was in the computer club at my high school and stayed there till 5 o'clock every day programming the Apple II, Apple II Plus, finally getting my own Franklin Ace 1000, which
did,
was a...
Did your dad buy that for you?
What's that?
Did your mom and dad buy that for you?
Oh, they did. Yeah, it was $2,500. Mm. There's no way I could have swung that. I think that was a clone of an Apple IIe or maybe just an Apple II Plus.
How much did you love that computer, though?
I loved it so much. I had that for 10 years.
Wow, that's a long time compared to nowadays.
Yeah, I don't even remember what happened to it. But when everyone else was using the early original Macs, I was still using my Franklin Ace 1000.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's a big investment for parents, though. $2,500 is not small potatoes.
No, it wasn't, but they saw it as an investment in my future, and it probably was. It was probably more valuable than any other money spent on education for me. I mean, that was when I was doing my 6502 machine language was my favorite thing in the world.
So this was late 70s, early 80s.
This was early 80s. Yeah, I graduated high school in 83, so mm-hmm. this was, probably 81 through, you know, like 1990, I think is about when I finally switched over and started using a Mac.
Well, you think about it, though, it was that much money then. How much money would that cost now? Today, it would cost you $4,000.
That's a question for Wolfram Alpha.
Yeah, there you go. let's say it was 1982. Let's see if Siri could figure this out for us real quick.
Okay.
How much would $2,500 be today? Oh, I messed that up. In 1983, compared to today, how much is $2,500? I still think I messed that up.
What would you like me to convert $2,500 to?
Actual cash in my pocket.
I don't understand.
I'm sure there's a better way of asking that question. I'm flaking out because I'm recording a live podcast, right?
That's all right. We'll take it for granted. Let's just say,
yeah, it'd be $4,000 today. Let's just go with that. That's a big investment. Did your parents believe that computer science was in your future, that this is really how you were going to make a living when you grew up?
Definitely. In fact, there was an immediate motivation for them. At the time, my stepdad was doing trying his hand at being an Amway distributor,
oh.
which is something that I've talked about on my show since then. And
poking holes in it, I hope.
What's that?
Poking holes in it, I hope.
Well, yes, mm-hmm. obviously about multi-level marketing in general. But at the time, he was taking more of a 30,000-foot view of it, and he was saying, "Hey, let's create some software for Amway distributors to use to run their businesses." And so I spent most of one summer creating that. We called it AmaCalc, and it was all written in BASIC and used text files as the database storage. And but it worked. It let you run your Amway business and kept track of all of your purchases and sales and your inventory. And gosh, I don't remember, but it was pretty cool.
Yeah, it sounds. I mean, especially at your age, then you're pretty young to be thrown into a project like that, but I have to imagine that it really made you appreciate the power of a computer, even a relatively unpowerful one that you were using.
Well, you know, in fact, now that you mention it, at that time, I don't think I'd ever seen business software at all. You know, it was not ubiquitous. At best, people were using word processors on computers, but business software was just not a thing that was around yet.
No, not then.
I pretty much had to make it up on my own.
That's kind of impressive. So you're a multi-billionaire now, right?
Yes, exactly. That.
Thank you, Amway. Amway's actually, their corporate headquarters is in, they're about an hour and a half north of me in Grand Rapids, oh, yeah? Michigan. Yeah. So I hear about Amway quite a bit. I have no interest in Amway.
Well, you shouldn't have any interest in Amway.
No, absolutely not.
In fact, as a way to segue into my show, the most interesting factoid that surfaced as a result of my research into multi-level marketing. And let me actually pull up the exact number here so I give you it correctly. I'll just read you this sentence. On average, 99.95% of network marketers lose money
Mm-hmm.
However, only 97.14% of Las Vegas gamblers lose money by placing everything on a single number at roulette. So if you're thinking about joining a network marketing plan and aren't dissuaded by the facts I've presented, consider instead going to Vegas and placing all your money in a single pile on number 13. So you are far more likely to win doing that than you are by joining any sort of multi-level marketing program.
I had moved to Houston right out of high school in the 80s, very briefly. I wasn't there very long. And I went to a job interview, and it was a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
And after about 20 minutes, this guy's got this whiteboard, and he's talking about it. And I get up because I'm just going to walk out. And he says, "Where are you going?" And I said, "This isn't for me." I wasn't going to be insulting. And he said, "What do you mean it's not for you? You don't like money?" I said, "I love money. I just don't like a pyramid scheme." And he goes, "This is not a pyramid scheme." And he had drawn this diagram where the person at the top and then the two people and then the people. It's literally a picture of a pyramid that he drew. And I said, "Yes, it's a pyramid scheme." And he goes, "No, it's not." So I walk up there. I take the pen off the little thing underneath. It's a, you know, the whiteboard. And I just draw a triangle around his diagram, set it down, and walked out. It might have been one of the greatest moments of my young adulthood.
Yeah. That's very good. That's very good.
It's a pyramid. You just made a pyramid, and you're telling me this and that. But I can understand why people fall for it, but it's so frustrating for people like us who just want to shake people and go, "Stop it." They're just robbing you. That's all they're doing.
Yeah, the basic sales pitch is extremely compelling to someone who has not put any time into thinking about it themselves, which is, look, let's say you talk to 1,000 people and 5 of them, just 5, that's a very realistic number, 5 of them are into what you have to say. And you look at the numbers, you know, 5 and then 5 below them and 5 below them and this much money, mathematically, you must become a millionaire. There's no way around it. It's a really compelling presentation, and almost everyone believes it. But then you look at that, for that one model to work, for that one thing that he just drew on the board to actually happen in reality to anyone, would require the participation of more human beings than have ever existed.
Yes, especially gullible ones. Well, yeah. No, you know what? I take that back. That gullible humans is an ample supply.
it's almost a redundant term.
It is. It absolutely is. And that's got to be a frustrating aspect of humanity to you with your show, where you're looking at critical analysis. And I know sometimes it seems to me in the world today that critical analysis doesn't seem as important as it once did.
You bring up an important point, I think, and that's in referring to people as gullible. And it's true that people are very easily fooled, but what's important is that you realize that you need to include yourself in that set.
Oh,
sure. The easiest person in the world to fool is yourself.
Absolutely.
And our brains fool ourselves every day.
Well, I mean, the divorce rate wouldn't be what it is if we didn't fool ourselves. And I'm not trying to be a cynic, but we all fool ourselves every single day about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife loves me. No, maybe she doesn't. I have a great job. Well, maybe you don't. I mean, the weather's great. No, it's not. But critical thinking is so important that how do we get more people thinking this way? Obviously, you're doing your part. You have a show that's very popular, and people are downloading and listening to it. And the people that are listening to it are passing that knowledge on to others. Either they're talking about your show, or they're learning about something on your show that they thought was true and went, "Oh, I didn't know that." And they're telling other people. So you're doing your part. But as a culture, how do we change that thinking? Or can we?
I think that's a very, very difficult proposition. And I think the people who do the same thing that I do, we're not in danger of going out of business anytime soon. The problem is that brains are hardwired for anecdotal thinking, and it's an evolved trait. This whole thing of conspiracy theories are part of the same thing. Our brains are evolved to try and see intelligent purpose in everyday mundane events, Our brains are hardwired to give a lot of priority to things that we perceive, things that we saw or heard or thought we saw or heard. Our brains insist that that is a literal factual account of what must have happened, even though anyone who sits down and thinks about it can realize, yeah, there's all kinds of perceptual errors in the world. But nevertheless, the brain's first impression is to go with what it thinks happened, what it perceives. And we're all just so primed to want to believe in all of these attractive things that are for sale in the market, that it's miraculously easy to lose weight by buying this product,
mm-hmm.
or it's miraculously easy, anything. The market is overflooded with products in product schemes, pyramid schemes we were just talking about. That's another perfect example. It's miraculously easy to make all the money you could ever dream for. People want to believe these things, and so they wholeheartedly embrace them, and they're very passionate about it. Now, that's just the way that all human beings are, you and me included. And so I'm never going to go out of business in trying to offer people an alternate perspective and get people to stand back and consider, wait a minute, maybe my first impression was not necessarily right. Maybe there's more to this, and maybe what's actually underneath the surface is more interesting and more fascinating, and I can learn more from it. And I think that's been key to the success of my show, why I've been doing it for so many years now, is because I hear that from people all the time. They said, wow, this was really cool when I heard this episode, this particular episode that got me to reconsider this one particular thing, whatever it was that I'd always believed my whole life. That really opened a door for me. I say, wow, I'm really excited about learning and all these other things now.
How much hate mail do you get from people that still, even listening to the evidence that you provide, still just refuse? They were with you for 20 episodes, but then you hit this one subject, they're like, oh, no. How many of those emails do you get?
Well, every week. The shows are incredibly diverse, and every week, exactly what you just described, verbatim, happens. Someone's been listening to the show for years, and then I happened to hit their particular sacred cow.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them I did in this past month that have been among the biggest ever. One of them was talking about global warming. The subject of the show was, there's this claim now, this belief that, hey, back in the 1970s, scientists thought we were going into a new ice age. And so if scientists were wrong then they're probably wrong now about global warming. So the point of the episode was going back into history and saying, okay, what actually was the scientific consensus in the 1970s? Well, this show brought all of the global warming deniers out of the closet. And I got all kinds of emails such as, I've been a supporter for years and I will no longer be supporting your show. And the other one was a Holocaust denial. Mm. And that brought all of the closeted all of the closeted anti-Semites, they came to the website and just deluged it with comments denying that the Holocaust happened. And same thing, I get the email saying, you know, I've been a supporter for years, and now that you are denying the Holocaust instead of taking a skeptical look at this new evidence, it's always how they phrase it.
Yes.
That by dismissing the scientific consensus and not embracing a fringe perspective, I'm not being skeptical.
But you live for that, don't you?
Exactly.
That's what people don't realize. As a fellow podcaster, I get this. When you get those type of emails, instead of making you go, oh, wait a minute, maybe I really screwed up here, it does actually the opposite, doesn't it? It really kind of, this is why I do it. Look at the reaction I'm getting from people by speaking mm-hmm. the truth. And if they don't like it, and I'm getting this kind of reaction, well, I got to be doing something right.
Well, you know, before we started recording, you and I were chatting a bit, and you were talking about hand coding your own RSS feed for the podcast. And when you said that, it reminded me that in that format, that RSS format, there's one little field that's, I think it's called a subtitle mm-hmm. or something like that, or a log line or slogan or something, that doesn't appear in iTunes. In fact, it doesn't appear anywhere I've ever seen it. But it's still in my RSS feed, and that is, the truth always hurts someone.
I love that. That's fantastic.
And I regret that that's never shown up as a subtitle on my show, because it's a great little saying, and it's true.
It absolutely is. you know, we all have these little beliefs that we kind of hold dear sometimes. And if somebody comes along with their reasoning, it can smart. And some people just, they don't want to believe. They want to stay in this little bubble, and this is what I believe in, and how dare you come into my little bubble and pop it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we like our comfort food.
That we do, yeah. people are very comfortable in their comfort zone, and when they hear something that basically... When you present a pro-science perspective to someone who holds a non-scientific point of view, they take it as a personal attack,
mm-hmm.
almost all the time. They never take it as an alternate perspective worthy of consideration. They take it as a personal attack. And that's the one thing that I've tried to improve over all of these years of doing my show, is trying to present the information in a way that people are more likely to embrace it.
Well, science is supposed to be without passion, because it's science. It's this is true and this is false. There's no reason to be passionate about the truth or something that's not true, because these are just facts. And how do you get, you know, fired up about facts unless other people don't believe those facts?
Well, there's facts and there's theories.
Yes.
And this is a subject that comes up all the time. And the best way for people to understand what is the scientific meaning of those words, because they're not the same thing, is the fact of gravity is that things fall when you drop them. The theory of gravity is how and why that happens and all the equations that describe it. Now, nobody denies that things fall when you drop them. That's a fact. That's an observation. That's a measurement. We can prove that that happens. The theory of gravity is a lot more nuanced, and that's where we have room for new information, and that's, you know, Newton gave us a theory of gravity. Einstein improved that theory of gravity, and you know that's pretty much where we are now. And will it be improved again in the future? I don't know. Between those two guys, they pretty much hit all the major points. There's probably some nuances that still remain to be learned, but the basic theory of gravity is not likely to change. And it's the same with all of these other subjects. When you talk about global warming, there's the fact of global warming, and there's the theory of global warming. Now, the facts are all of the data that we can look at, you know, the ice core data, the temperature, you know, what have you. The theory, though, is far more complicated and far more nuanced. These equations that describe all of this, and these probability curves looking into the future, and the things that we can measure now, like the amount of whatever carbon dioxide in the atmosphere or whatever it is, how these things affect these probability equations, and how changing a variable today will alter these curves looking forward into the future. It's fascinating, and it's unfortunately, when people talk about that question, they see it as black and white. Oceans are going to catastrophically destroy the planet tomorrow, or everything's fine. It's between those two. Well, the oceans haven't catastrophically risen and killed everyone yet, so everything's fine. It's very difficult to get people to see, hey, wait, if you actually take an hour and read some of this stuff and try to learn how these equations are constructed, it's fascinating. And it's a wonderful gift to yourself that anyone can give, is just this new understanding and a new perspective to realize that there's far more nuance involved than these black and white questions.
I had my, I had closed my laptop. No, I think this was 2 weeks ago. No, last week when I was in LA. And, I had Facebook open when I closed it. Opened it up the next morning. And you know how, I don't know if you use Facebook, but they got the little things on the right, the top stories.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the top stories was, and remember this was from the day before, pastor says world's going to end on, and it was that day.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess I made it. So you're coming up, if my math is correct, right around the beginning of next year, you're going to hit 500 episodes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's 11 weeks away, I think.
Yeah. So I guess that's still this year then, isn't it?
I don't know. November, December. It's pretty close.
It's pretty close.
Right around the new year.
Do you have big plans for that 500th episode? Because that's a milestone right there. That's nothing you can just overlook. That's 500 episodes.
Well, okay, you ask kind of a loaded question there, because I have a milestone every 50 episodes. I do a lavish musical. And that's something that almost all of my listeners hate. Now, I figure, hey, this is my show. This is what I slave blood, sweat, and tears on all day, every day. I'm going to give myself a treat and do an episode just for me that I enjoy doing. So I make these lavish musicals. Some of them I've spent a ton of money on as well, and some of them have not. But there are plans for a 500th episode. Although those plans are extremely sketchy right now, and I'm kind of looking at the calendar.
You've got 11 weeks. That's around the corner.
It's not a lot of time, yeah, especially when music has to be composed and performers are going to be hired, things like that.
You're going all out.
I mean, you got to work around the schedules of a lot of real professionals who are doing other things. So it's not a lot of time. And a lot of it hinges on my coming up, solidifying the idea, and I usually write the lyrics, all of them or most of them, and then it goes into the hands of a composer, and then we figure out, okay, how are we going to do the recording and scheduling, how many performers are going to need to be hired, what are we going to do, and then sometimes we'll shoot a video alongside of it, and, well, that takes time. In all the same ways. So 11 weeks, yeah, suddenly I might be going back to a fallback plan. Which I don't have that either right now.
I'm looking forward to finding out what it's going to be. And for those wondering, by the way, yes, I do have the dreaded three random questions coming up. So don't think Brian's getting away from that. We definitely have that coming up.
Let me make one little pitch here.
Okay.
Episode number, I want to say 300. Let me make sure about that. Of the Skeptoid podcast, which was in March 6, 2012. That was a little animated fairy tale. It was a great little fairy tale. We actually ended up making a book that you can buy, a little colored children's book. And it was sung. I was narrating the fairy tale, and the singer was Rachel Bloom, whose TV show debuted last night on television, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And so I'm just kind of jumping up and down all excited. It's like, yeah, I worked with her once.
That's amazing. That's really cool.
She is super talented, and she's just the world's nicest person. And so it was wonderful to get a chance to work with her and wonderful to see all this great success that she's having now. So all you people who are skeptical of these 50th musical episodes, hey.
Someone got a TV show from it.
It's the fast track to success, yes.
I'm sure it was that episode that landed her this role.
I'm sure it was that in its entirety.
So let's go back in time. You don't have a podcast yet. Podcasting has been invented, and it's been around only for a couple years at that point. What was it about podcasting, and was there any certain podcasts or podcasts that kind of drew you in and thought, you know what, I want a podcast?
Yes, exactly. That's actually exactly how it happened. When I learned that there was such a thing as a podcast and kind of got the idea, it's like, oh, wait, so you mean my phone or computer or whatever will automatically download? It's like time-shifted radio. It's like TiVo for your radio.
Yep.
And I can listen to my favorite show whenever I want in my car, which is, you know, the super convenient way everyone does it.
Absolutely.
And I began to get, wow, that's really cool. So let's look at some of these. And so I opened up iTunes and found the podcast section and poked around and came upon one of the ones that was being promoted because it had been discussed, mentioned by Steve Jobs in one of his keynotes. And that was Skepticality with Derek and Swoopy. So that was probably 2005, 2006 that I saw that. And I downloaded 3, 4, or 5 episodes, listened to a couple of them, and said, you know what, this subject matter really appeals to me, and I have my own strong thoughts on this. And heck, I went to school for writing for film and television, and I was a computer science major, and this is exactly what I want to try. So I talked to my wife. I said, you know, hey, I know this is really stupid, and this is a distraction from things that actually earn money for our family, but I want to try making a podcast. I said, hey, I'll just make five episodes and I'll get it out of my system and then won't revisit the subject and won't waste any more time. And she said, yeah, go for it. Knock yourself out, idiot.
She doesn't listen to it, by the way. Can you tell that's the voice of experience there? She doesn't want to hear your podcast, by the way. She doesn't.
Yep.
It's the bane of every podcast, male podcaster out there. Your spouse does not want to listen to your podcast. Yes,
that is true.
So how did you go about actually recording that first episode? And what were your nerves like? And how did you pick the first subject? And what software did you decide on? I mean, what was the process to actually get that first episode out?
Wow. That's I'm not sure I remember.
No?
How did I do that? Because I had just been making some YouTube videos about some weird things that I had investigated. I made one about we took a plane ride out to Area 51. I went to Death Valley and filmed the moving stones. And I'd been making these YouTube videos about that, and I needed to record my narration for those. And the way I did that was do you remember those little white disc-shaped Apple microphones that would sit on your desk?
I absolutely do. Absolutely. Yep. Okay.
So I had one of those, and I took my computer and went out and sat in my car in the garage because I thought that was the quietest place. And I recorded the narration on that. And I was very unhappy with the audio quality. I did use it, but I was unhappy with it. So when I decided to make the podcast, did I already have a microphone? I don't think so. I think I actually bought a microphone. It was a handheld mic. I can't remember the name. It was a Shure something. It's like the most popular microphone that's ever existed. And I bought it, you know, for, I don't know, $75 or something like that. And just handheld. And I recorded it handheld like that. And I must have used GarageBand. Was GarageBand even out in 2006? Yeah, it must
have. I believe so.
It must have been.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And the only reason I know is because I, as a podcaster myself at the time, a local news company actually came out and did a story on me and my podcast partner at the time. And I was trying to think, was it out? And that was in 2005, and they actually had a video of us recording in GarageBand. So that's the only reason I can remember that it was there.
Well, so I did that. I hand-coded the RSS, just typed it by hand, based on the excellent documentation that Apple provided. And I just loaded the audio files and just hosted them on my own web server. I had a web server that was, I don't remember where it was located at the time. And that's how it started. I don't think I did anything other than just list it in iTunes. At the time, I remember you had to have five episodes or iTunes wouldn't allow you to list your podcast. I don't know if that's still the case or not, but that was the case then. Okay. So I had to record all five of them and put it up there. I had no trouble coming up with what those five ideas would be, because when I heard Derek and Swoopy's show, Skepticality, you know, it immediately suggested it was all of these pop culture things that people believe that aren't true. And I selected Rods was one of my episodes. Rods are, in case you're not familiar, it's
finding the water thing and the precious metal.
Not divining rods.
Oh, okay.
Not housing rods. But the paranormal explanation is that these are flying creatures who are not visible to the naked eye, but they show up on film, and they're shaped like a rod with a wavy line going down the side with which they kind of swim through the air at high speed.
Brian, I don't visit enough websites, I guess, because I had never heard of that.
when you see a photograph of a rod, you kind of slap yourself in the forehead that anyone would misinterpret it because it's so obvious what it is. It's simply an insect moving over the length of the camera shutter, flapping its wings as it goes, and so it makes a wavy line. And I mean, that's flagrantly obvious to anyone and everyone who knows anything at all about photography. And yet this subculture persists in this belief that there's these invisible alien creatures living among us. So I did an episode on that and four other subjects that were similar. that were all had been kind of pet peeves of mine. And that was it. I started, to my great surprise, I started getting emails from people saying they liked it and I should do an episode on this or I should do an episode on that. And I literally have not needed an idea since then. People send in ideas far faster than I'll ever be able to keep up with them. There's something like 400 good ideas in my folder that I haven't gotten to yet. And that means I've excluded all the ones that were stupid ideas or that I wasn't feeling interested enough in. So, yeah, I'll be doing this for a very long time.
Well, fans will be happy to hear that. How does your wife feel about you podcasting after those initial five that, let's be honest, you said it was probably only going to be five. You get it out of your system. And here you are, a decade later, you're still doing it. It's still going strong. Is she happy about it? Or is it one of those, well, it's his thing?
Well, she's always been very supportive. She's great. She saw early on that I was really enjoying it, and so that was great for her. That, you know, something to put a smile on my face, so I'm not moping around the house depressed about work or something. But since then, since about 2008, I incorporated it. 2010, I began making it my full-time job. And 2012, it became a nonprofit. So now it's, you know, very much my job and a half.
It's who you are.
Yeah. It's, you know, my name is synonymous with this podcast. And my wife there's a board of, since it's a nonprofit, we have a board of directors that actually governs what happens. And they appointed her the executive director because there's... And basically what she does is she mainly acts as the secretary and deals with a bunch of clerical headache stuff that I just simply don't have time to do. I'm just so swamped with all of the other – because the podcast is now only one of the programs that the nonprofit produces. There's others as well. And so it's been just the most wonderful, fulfilling career that that anyone could ever ask for.
And let's be honest, for just one subject, if you're not already an expert in that subject, and who is on this many subjects, you actually have to go out there and do the research before you can sit down in front of a microphone and speak intelligently about it.
Yeah, it's the show's only 12 minutes long, and to come up with 12 minutes of material for a subject that I have no more expertise on than anyone, it takes me a full week's immersion in research on that topic.
And that's probably what people don't get, that kind of research and dedication on your end to learn the source material before you record a show.
Since it's been my profession now for so long, I've gotten pretty good. I think I've got professional level research skills as far as how to find the good sources, how to skip the bad sources, know what's a reliable source, know what's not, and be able to go in and get the original story, get the latest research, and be able to put together an accurate picture of any given subject. But it takes a lot of work to do. It's not something that I haphazardly sit down at a microphone and just make something up as I go. Every episode's written, for example. It's not just spoken off the cuff. It's all written in advance. And
so that, you prepare, unlike me.
Yeah, I spend my entire career preparing for a podcast and then, you know, a couple hours recording and editing it. It's a lot of fun, though. I mean, 90% of it is screwing around on the internet, and who doesn't want to do that for a living?
HBO comes knocking on your door, and they want to turn this into a Penn and Teller type of show. You know, the one I'm talking about. And I'm not going to say the name of it here on this show because, well, this is a G-rated show. Mm-hmm. Would you be interested in something like that?
Absolutely. That's very much part of our mission at the nonprofit is that kind of outreach. Anything that increases the audience or increases the visibility of this material is very much what we do. So, yes, I would be thrilled in that. It's happened a dozen times. I've shot a bunch of TV pilots. They're usually kind of dumb ideas that are not very well differentiated from what's out there. I co-produced a pilot with my friend Ryan Johnson, who brought me the idea initially. And we sat down and we hired our own experts and we put together an hour pilot of a show called The Skeptologists. And I think we learned a lot of lessons doing that, and we'd have better luck if we did it a second time, but we spent all our money the first time. So I don't know if we'll get a chance to do that again, but it was a great experience. And we got so close to a network deal with that show. We had great agents representing it. We had meetings with all of the major networks and some of the cable networks. And we actually got closest with a cable network called True TV.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have had a deal on, I'm not sure what channel it is, but they did produce a show called Harry Bikers. Harry Bikers ended up getting the slot that we would have otherwise had. So,
which, of course, went on to win the Emmy, as we all know.
So, yeah. So, you know, it kind of makes you step back and realize, okay, this is how people see this material. It's in a class with Harry Bikers.
No, it's not. The problem is you're dealing with a network who has a lot of different personalities, and a lot of different sponsors they want to reach out to. And it's probably easier to get Rogaine as a sponsor of Harry Bikers than it would be a show like yours that's, you know, poking holes into a sacred cow for some people.
Yeah. Well, here's the question that we were universally asked. They wanted to know, well, the paranormal explanation is going to turn out to be the true one, at least some of the time, right, guys? And, you know, being naive and not knowing how to spin this yet, we said, well, no, we're the opposite of that. We're going to, and they, you know, kind of at that point, they say, well, we're not interested.
Right.
They really only want to promote sensationalism.
Right. But the answer, of course, is, oh, absolutely. And then once you actually start making the show and it's a hit, well, then it's not up to them.
Yeah. What was so funny is before and after the meeting started, you know, before and after the meat of the meeting, these guys would be so thrilled about the material, and they'd all want to chat about it. They'd all ask their question, oh, what about this mystery? And what about this mystery? What's going on with the Bermuda Triangle? I want to know all these things. And I'd answer all these questions, and they were thrilled by that. But then when it comes time to, well, what's going to be on the show, you're going to show that the Bermuda Triangle is actually alien, right?
They want sensationalism. It sells. I mean, at the end of the day, unfortunately, television is about entertainment. And yeah. For the vast majority of people, the scientific explanation to Bigfoot or the Bermuda Triangle or the Loch Ness Monster isn't as entertaining as, you know, the mythology that's around those subjects.
I argue that the reason what you say is absolutely true is because those producers are not putting enough work into the subject. They're taking the easy way out.
Sure.
Because it is possible to make all of those subjects just as sensational and just as fascinating and stick to what's true. You just have to put a lot more work into digging deeper and finding what's the really interesting angle about it. And for just for one example, take something everyone's heard of, the whole Roswell thing, the aliens, alien autopsy at Roswell, the UFO crashed on the ranch and the alien bodies were inside of it. That's a sensational version of the story, and everyone wants to believe that. But to me, that's so old and tired because it's just a stupid made-up story that there's a billion of out there. And I'm more interested in how and why that came to be such a popular story.
The psychology, behind it?
It's a sociology question. How did this happen? Why did it happen? How can we see the same thing happening today in other questions? And to me, that's really interesting. And so I will try and always go that direction with the material.
To me, that would make a better show. That's a show I'm definitely interested in watching.
Yeah, and that's a real valuable lesson. And people will walk away. You've actually given them something. Too often, this whole field that I work in, people say, oh, it's debunking. It's telling people that this isn't true or their cherished belief isn't true. Well, that's often the case. If you stop at just saying, oh, your ghost isn't real. It was a creaking door. The wind was making the door creak and there was a reflection. It's not a ghost. That's an inherently negative process. That's an inherently negative. It's just taking something away from people. And I never want to do that with any of my episodes. I want to give them something. Okay, maybe that's true. Maybe it was a reflection in the creaking door. But let's understand why the brain reinterprets that as something else. And let's see, oh, there's actually a name for that, for what happens. And it also is manifested in these other ways. And that's something that someone can look at and go, whoa, that's really cool. You've given them something rather than simply taken something away.
Talk to me about tube amplifiers. That's your most popular show right now on your website. And this is something I've talked about myself on other shows that, I get why people would think that that would sound better. But in actuality, it doesn't.
Okay. Well, first of all, a disclaimer, that was one that was guest hosted. So I didn't write that episode. But I can tell you that it's basically the whole concept of high-end audio. And people who are into tube amplifiers as opposed to digital amplifiers, or vinyl instead of digital recordings, or what have you, super expensive speaker cable instead of lamp cord. You can see the same thing happening across all of these product areas. And that's basically that, especially today, even cheap stuff on the market reproduces sound way better than our ears can distinguish. There's no reason to spend $10,000 on an amplifier that's going to sound completely indistinguishable from a $75 amplifier. The great thing about this subject is you will not find anywhere on the planet, in any subject, people who are more passionate about their preferred belief.
That doesn't surprise me. I used to consider myself an audiophile.
Yeah, me too, but it was in my high school days.
Yeah, right. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a difference between a cheap pair of headphones and a really nice pair of headphones. But that usually has to do with the components being used. But when it gets to the amplifiers and stuff, how loud it goes, whether it's a tube or a chip, or it sounds the same when it comes out of the speakers.
Yeah, it's not an important part of the chain. By far, the most important parts of audio reproduction are the speakers and the room.
Yeah, that and the source material.
Oh, and what's that?
And the source material. I mean, the difference between a cassette tape and a CD, for instance. There's a huge difference.
Well, sure, between a cassette tape and a CD, but that's because a cassette had huge limitations that were, you know, obviously well below the threshold of what we could tell apart.
Right.
But one of the requests I'm getting a lot now is different types of digital recordings. We've got, and I don't even know what they are. So I'm sure some of your listeners know about this far better than I do. But the super new high fidelity digital audio files that have different compression schemes or different sampling rates or whatever it is sound so much better than the CD spec. And that's just simply demonstrably not false.
Yeah, it's nonsense.
I almost said exactly the opposite of what I meant. And a great way to illustrate this is to, when you look at the waveform of, you know, a trumpet note, whatever it is, a given trumpet note that's been recorded, and you look at how it's reproduced in data on these various digital formats, and you can see that the waveform will differ a little bit, but you could overlay them and you see basically the same waveform, just with, you know, different steps or maybe different nuances. But then you hear the same trumpet player play the exact same note a different time, and everything will be completely different in that waveform. And it kind of nails home the point that the differences you were looking at the first time are completely insignificant. Because even though as humans we can't tell those two exact same trumpet notes apart, their waveforms have nothing to do with each other. And instead we're debating over these tiny nuances in one particular waveform.
But if you can't feel it unless it's... Yeah, right.
and that's largely what it comes down to. Because the thing with tube amplifiers is really similar to the people who like their vinyl records. It's much more than just listening to music. There's a whole experience associated with it. It's the smell of the cardboard sleeve as you pull it out. It's, you know, the feel of actually putting the needle down on the record. It's watching the little stroboscope that shows the speed the turntable is rotating at. It's a very physical connection that you have to the media when you play it. And the same thing with tube amps, especially these ones that, where the tubes are exposed. You know, you can feel the glow from them. You see the light from them. It's a whole experience. And that's where the value of that lay. I'm not saying that there's no value in that experience. That's cool. That's part of it. That's the reason people buy Ferraris, is because, you know, there's all of these sort of intangible qualities associated with the device.
And feelings do have a place in society, how something makes you feel. Absolutely.
Sure.
How much do you love talking about stuff like this, Brian?
More than anyone I have ever talked to. So
it's great, isn't it?
The most boring guy in the room.
No, I would disagree with you there. I love talking about exactly the same things that we're talking about here. Unfortunately, we don't have 5 hours because there's so many topics I would love to get into. But one topic definitely we need to get into right now is the three random questions. Are you ready?
I am ready, sir.
All right. These are Brian Dunning's three random questions. Number one. I try not to be too Barbara Walters. I don't really, you know, I'm not into making people cry on the show, but this one might get you.
Okay.
Do you like to dance?
I am not a big dancer.
When's the last time you went dancing? Was
I
it a wedding?
I can tell you that exactly. No. If you search YouTube for Death Valley Disco.
Oh, no.
You will see my son and I dancing. We went out. We made a little video of ourselves disco dancing in various places throughout Death Valley National Park. And you'll look at me dancing, and you'll see he probably shouldn't do that.
You're so much more brave than I am, Brian.
If you can't dance, at least shout it to the world by putting it on YouTube.
Absolutely. That's awesome.
Kids, Death Valley Disco. Go check it out.
I'm going to put a link to the video in the show notes for OWC Radio number 52. So you don't even have to search for it. Just go to the show page. I will have a link to the YouTube video, and I'm going to watch it after we get done talking. I promise I won't laugh. Okay, I won't promise that. Number two, what time do you get up in the mornings?
6 o'clock.
Really? That's same as me. I even without the alarm on, I'm up 6 o'clock.
Yeah, me too. I can't sleep past that. I just for fun, I always tell my iPad, wake me up at 6 a.m. just before I go to sleep at night. I don't set a regular alarm just because it's kind of fun to tell the iPad to do that, and it does it.
Yeah. It's so encoded in my own DNA now. I travel quite a bit for OWC. I was in L.A. last week. And anytime I go from the East Coast to the West Coast, I don't change my internal clock ever. I just can't because it's too difficult when I come back.
Yeah.
So I wake up and I'm in L.A. and it's 3 in the morning. I can't help it. I'm up and ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to set an alarm for – I do – because I'm not crazy. But if I have to be at the, you know, LAX at 6 a.m., I know I'm going to make it no problem at all, because to me, that's 9 o'clock in the morning. So I don't need the alarm clock anymore.
Do you travel internationally much?
No. No, thankfully. Would probably really mess me up.
Because I speak at every conference that I can get to, and a lot of them are overseas. And when you're going all of a sudden halfway around the world, for a while I had an Ambien prescription just for that reason. You know, I'd knock myself out when I got on the plane, or, you know, I'm in Germany in the middle of the night, 10 o'clock, I'd take an Ambien and try and force myself onto some kind of a schedule. It kind of works, but after 2-3 days, I mean, yeah, it catches up with you and it's not sustainable.
We're creatures of habits.
Yeah. Creatures of biorhythms.
Yes. My son seems to be more like me when it comes to waking up in the morning. We're the first two on the weekends up by at least an hour. Just the two of us. I wake up before him, but he's always the second one up without fail.
That's cool.
Last one. If you had a big win in the lottery, which presumes that you would ever play the lottery, how long would you wait until you told people? So you tomorrow you win $50 million in the state lotto. How long before you start spreading the word that you won? Or would you?
No, I probably wouldn't. I mean,
nothing good's going to come out of telling everybody.
Yeah, from everything I've heard, yeah, there's nothing good comes from winning a lottery. And so many people say it ruins their lives. It ruins their families, their friendships. Years ago, I worked as a paralegal, and for some reason there were a number of clients who were they were either lottery winners themselves or they were friends or family of lottery winners. And every one of these situations was just a disaster. I remember one guy who decided to get his payments in the annual, you know, the annual payments he received.
Right.
And he took the first annual payment, blew it immediately, got himself into huge debt, received the second payment, paid off some of the debt, but not enough to make any difference, and was being pulled out of his home where he had barricaded himself by sheriff's deputies within a month after that. So, and thrown into jail with huge debt. What was he thrown into jail for? Because that was something. I don't remember. But yeah, it's. I would rather people not know. I would set up trust funds. I'd take care of my kids and my family, my elderly relatives that need the help, and get the heck out of Dodge. Get myself a nice ranch somewhere in the middle of nowhere that has good internet.
New cars and a nice house is about the only thing I would really get extravagant on. I'm not buying boats or planes or any of that stuff. The kids would be taken care of, and it would just, for me, it would just take, you know, that worry, that money worry away. But I would still work. I could not work.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, they say money is, can't buy happiness, and that's true. But the lack of money can cure the sources of a lot of unhappiness.
Well, money definitely doesn't make people happy. What makes me happy is doing a show like this, and I get to meet someone like Brian Dunning. It was great to meet you and have you on OWC Radio. Where can people find you online to get more information on the show, on you? Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. I'm Brian Dunning on Twitter. Easy enough. The easiest way is skeptoid.com. SKEPTOID. There's skeptoid.org also. That's the website for the nonprofit. The podcast and all the information about me is on skeptoid.com, and you can follow the Facebook and Twitter and all of that stuff from the links at the top of that page.
Brian, thanks very much for being here this week on OWC Radio. I really do appreciate it. And I'd love to have you on again sometime. Maybe we'll find a topic that we could bring you on and kind of debunk, you know, those who believe that Windows is a good platform. I'm kidding. I use Windows myself occasionally. I've got like 4 Windows computers. So, but I know the Mac users would love to hear that. Thanks a lot.
There's a Windows computer in my closet somewhere.
Yeah. You're a closeted Windows user is what you're saying.
Exactly.
But the Windows in my house actually runs my arcade machines, a couple of them. So they have their place. The right tools for the right thing. Well, the problem is the software that I need to run old arcade games, they're not all converted over to the Mac. Thus, a little tiny PC, the one that can fit in the size of your hand, works great.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Brian, thanks very much for being here. Appreciate it.
I loved it. Let's do it again.
So for those who are looking to upgrade your Mac or you need external storage, make sure you visit MacSales.com. We've got great hardware. If you need a lot of storage space, take a look at MacSales.com. We have award-winning, fantastic products, especially if you've got a machine that's hooked up to a Thunderbolt 2 dock. Ugh, the speed you can get, the reliability that you're going to get with a RAID system will blow your mind. MacSales.com. And make sure you're following us on Twitter at MacSales. And we're on Facebook, of course. We'll see you guys in a week.